thank you for listening to the Nordic Africa podcast, a series of pod conversations about current trends and issues in Africa. I'm Heba Habib, communications officer at the Institute. I am, alas, sans Henrik, my colleague today, but we have a great episode ahead of us exploring developments in Russia-Africa relations. Over recent years, Russia has emerged as a prominent external actor on the continent, with a notable focus on deepening ties in North Africa, extending its reach in Central African Republic and the Sahel through the infamous Wagner Group, and reigniting Cold War connections in Southern Africa. However, the shadow of Russia's invasion of Ukraine falls hard on Putin's attempts to strengthen his diplomatic relationships with African leaders, and the responses to the invasion have differed a lot between African states. With us here to analyze recent developments in Russia-Africa relations are Angela Muvamba-Sellstrom, researcher at the Nordic Africa Institute. Welcome.
Thank you.
Henning Melber, Nye Associate.
Thanks a lot.
Very welcome. And Patience Msusa via Zoom, researcher at the Nordic Africa Institute. Welcome.
Thanks.
Okay. So let's start with the basics. What are the basic interests of Russia in Africa? And have they increased in recent years? And if so, why?
Well, I think under the current circumstances with the invasion of the Ukraine, the basic interest is to take as many of the African states, meaning the heads of state, on board in the sense that they are not openly in condemnation of that move. That's the bottom line, I would say, under the current circumstances. And what we witness since the invasion of the Ukraine are efforts by Russia to manipulate public opinion, to orchestrate campaigns which put the blame on NATO and the Ukraine as the perpetrators, deviating from their own violation of the UN Charter, which is very important because as UN member states, Africans vote in the General Assembly, and important is the voting pattern, and it's of course also not only closely followed by Russia but also by the West.
I think that that's where we are right now. I think that Russia's interest in Africa is long-standing, and it's taken quite a while for Russia to return to Africa in a way. I think after the end of the Cold War, there was a period of time where Russia really retreated. But I think that this new kind of position globally of a kind of multipolar order and the emergence of other powers and regional powers, the increasing fragmentation and fractures and fissures at the UN, on the Security Council between Russia, China, and the US in particular, all of those have played a part. I think that Russia's interest in Africa has become tangled up a lot in its export of military weapons and technology. It has signed a number of significant military defense agreements, I think, with half of the continent. You know, the equivalent amount of money I think those agreements reach is almost $3 billion. So I think that there's quite a lot of economic and military and geopolitical interests that Russia has in using Africa, both as a playing ground for its defense and military industries, but also as a partner in further sort of disrupting the global order and creating or cementing this notion that there is a, it's not really even a notion anymore, but that really that there is no longer a single unipolar world where the United States is at the top. And I think that that's a big part of what Russia wants from Africa. And I think that that African governments have played into that as well. I think that they've optimized that and instrumentalized the increasing chaos and disorder in the world. At the same time, the governments and the people of Africa have been victim to some of that chaos and disorder.
Brilliant. Patience, do you have anything to add?
Yes, just to add on Russia's economic interests in Africa. I mean, one, of course, it's been leveraging in this particular context the food crisis that has arisen out of his invasion of Ukraine. But kind of longer standing to that also is his interest actually in expanding his economic interests in energy. And this, I think, is kind of an area which is has been, at least in the kind of last Russia-Africa summit that was there, a kind of area of interest to African countries, in particular as the African continent has a large energy deficit. And as it pursues policy of industrialization as a way to transform its economies from primary commodity exporters to manufacturing, means that several countries have been considering the use of small nuclear energy plants, but not only that, kind of exploration of liquid natural gas reserves, of which Russia has been extending expertise and financing with several countries at the previous Russia-Africa summit in 2019, signing cooperation agreements with the Russian state energy company. Whether the interest to pursue energy cooperation in this area continues, given the war and the risks associated with that, is unclear, but I guess we'll be seeing that in the next meeting. So there is it's kind of multiple areas. So the multipolarity that Angela has mentioned, but also the economic factors also play into that.
Will the peace talks in Russia and Kiev that happened, that were led by Cyril Ramaphosa, will they have any effect on the summit?
My understanding is that the talks didn't really produce any credible step forward or legitimate step forward in a negotiation process. I've understood that there's been pressure from the US government, for example, that African leaders going to the summit should also visit Kiev. So I do believe that there might be opportunities. I mean, summits are often places and locations where there are a number of mini negotiations that are taking place. But my understanding and my view is really that this isn't a ripe moment yet, unbelievably a ripe moment yet. African governments aren't in a position to guarantee or offer any incentive for Russia to engage in some form of peace process. I think that they might have hoped that they could be, given the fact that they are such enormous partners, you know, with Russia on military spending and training and minerals. I think that the capacity that African governments could have to leverage that role is very limited. It's very weak. I don't really know why. I don't know if it's because of institutional weaknesses in their foreign services, the capacity to formulate and negotiate very robust processes in the interest of African governments or in the interest of a better outcome between Ukraine and Russia. I don't see that capacity. I think there might even be a willingness on the part of some governments like South Africa. And I do believe that there is an important aspect. There is a genuine belief, perception amongst some African academics and policymakers that a negotiated outcome is ideal. But I just don't see that there is any institutional muscle or capacity to really step up the game in terms of using this summit as a staging ground or as an opportunity for those kinds of talks that are really important in any peace process.
Meta talks, okay. Yes, Henning.
I think the African initiative had some symbolic value.
Mm-hmm.
And that also matters in politics and diplomacy. It's an African initiative representing deliberately all regions of the continent. And as this initiative, it did not only talk to Russia, as most of the African governments did before. They came to Kiev and they talked to Zelensky. I think that's an important symbolic step in the right direction. I agree totally with Angela. That initiative has not really leverage in international politics, but symbolism has leverage too.
Mm.
On the other hand, it might serve as a kind of a weak excuse or justification why now in St. Petersburg, basically, as many leaders of the African continent are attending as they did in Sochi in 2019. But then again, as Angela pointed out, summits are there to also seek informal exchanges. And it will be very interesting, and everyone will closely watch to what extent the interaction there visibly raises issues which, for example, relate to the Sochi Declaration of 2019, which in its Articles 31 to 37 notably stressed legal cooperation, for example, explicitly regarding respect of international law, condemnation of unilateral military interventions, and using force in violation of the UN Charter. That was agreed in Sochi 2019. It would be a fantastic window of opportunity, if only subtly so, to point at that declaration now and revisit what you make about it in the current situation.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Patience, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, no, but I agree with both Henning and Angela. And I think there's a real opportunity for African countries actually from the context to also kind of coordinate a lot more their response to crises such as these. And one would hope that actually at the summit, there would be a kind of much more coordinated and have there be kind of much more consensus on the African position regarding Russia's invasion of Ukraine, because that's what would give the continent a little bit more leverage. I mean, as it is, actually, if you think back also to the early response in the COVID to the conflict last year, the response was uncoordinated, not just in South Africa, for example, where you had different responses and shifting responses from the foreign minister, but there had not been a continental response to discuss what the implications would be. And this highlights that there are difficulties at a continental and regional level in Africa in one, being able to kind of organize timely crisis response and also work towards general consensual responses. And this is important, and in particular, given the economic impact that the war has had on Africa's economies. And as they move towards greater regional integration, they should be assessing the risks, not just to individual countries, but also the wider regional implications. And this also means that the response in a context where you have a greater global power competition and a shift towards actually kind of potentially expanding war, African countries need to find their moral voice, not just as the right thing to do, but also that is within the strategic interest.
Interesting. So speaking of this sort of diversity and inability to come to a consensus to some extent, so there's been diverse reactions to the war amongst Africa's countries. Amongst the OECD countries in general, EU countries in general, the reaction to Russia's invasion of Ukraine has been almost unanimous. For example, all 38 OECD member countries voted in favor of condemning it in the UK. But in Africa, the reactions have varied greatly from country to country. But why has that been the case, Angela?
I'm happy to answer that, but I just want to just ping on to what Patience had just said.
Of course, go ahead.
And also to what you've just said about a coordinated response. And I did think that there could be, you know, that Russia has withdrawn from this special grain initiative.
The Black Sea Grain Initiative.
Mm-hmm. And my other wonder, what I wonder about, is whether or not at this summit, countries that have strong security arrangements with Russia, like Mali or Central African Republic, and other countries that have some other leverage, you know, so for example, that have very strong relations with other Western powers that are great beneficiaries of Western support or strong partners with China or the EU, if they might be able to use the summit and might use the summit as a way to also enter into separate bilateral agreements with Russia around grain. And for me, that would actually be a sign that the African countries have failed to coordinate and harmonize and really take advantage of this opportunity to coordinate and organize as a regional bloc, as a continental entity. And that's a kind of repetition of the general fragmentation and lack of unity amongst African governments. So turning to the UN votes that you were talking about, it's been a while. It was 20, it seems like so much has happened in the last year or so. So in 2022, there were these votes in the Security Council and the General Assembly around Russia. In the Security Council, the African member states all voted positively. I mean, positively meaning they were all unanimously against the invasion of Russia, against the attack on the Ukraine by Russia. In the General Assembly, the votes that took place in March and April of 2022 were really controversial, showed, you know, something like, I don't have the exact figure, but about 51%, let's say, about 51% of African governments, and that's really a guesstimate at this stage, who were either chose to be out of the room and not vote at all, or abstained, or voted no. And that you can see that there is a range of differences. And when I say voted no, they voted no on resolutions that would expel Russia from the UN Human Rights Council. Just that these resolutions in the General Assembly, essentially, that you I think everyone, and by everyone I mean the West, was quite surprised and stunned. And I think assumed that because of Europe and the US's longstanding trade and mostly aid development assistance to African governments, that, and also I think that there was a reading, I know that I had this reading, that African governments that had fought so hard or had such an ideological stance against colonialism and in favor of respecting sovereignty and territorial integrity in Africa, and even if you see their position around Palestine or around Western Sahara, or I mean this idea that a country can invade another country, it seems so almost un-African to me. But I think that what all of us failed to really grasp was that that these countries that had not sided against Russia, and I think it's important to think siding against Russia, they didn't want to side against Russia for various reasons. Some people will say, I think a lot will say, that there's a legacy of Soviet support to the liberation movements in Southern Africa when the West completely ignored and even supported the apartheid regime. That's one. Another is the post-Cold War conduct of the West. I mean, the invasion of Iraq, the failures around the Libyan, which was the first event where, you know, African presidents actually tried to intervene and to stop mass atrocity in Libya and were instructed or told not to by the West, so that the West could launch this coalition against, to protect civilians, ostensibly to protect civilians as part of the responsibility to protect, but in fact, it ended up being regime change. And there's never been any reckoning for these things. And I often say to people that we always decry and declaim African failure to go against Russia in this context and to uphold the rule-based international order. But I think that we have failed to really understand that the lack of a reckoning around how unfair and impunity-ridden the rule-based order is, what that really sends, what kind of signals, and not just symbolism, but deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, destruction of millions and millions of people's lives in the global south. I think an Africa without a seat at the permanent seat at the Security Council, I think the idea of abstaining from these votes isn't so controversial when you're sitting in an African capital and you're looking at this history of impunity by some governments and not others in this so-called rule-based international order, and you say, well, we do have these military and trade agreements with Russia, although Russia is by far the least trading partner in Africa compared to the EU or China, but still it has been a partner in some respects. Let's just stay out of it. It's just, I think that that's really what happened.
Well said.
I totally agree with Angela, and to put it a bit sarcastic, one could say the chicken come home to roost.
I think it's kind of also really important actually to also see where the possibilities lie. And I think in particular between Africa relations and the US and OECD countries to ensure that there isn't a further fragmentation. I think kind of much more generally, African countries are keen on a pluralistic approach to their international relations. They don't want to pick sides. In particular, as many of them, in particular in Southern Africa, bear the brunt of protracted liberation struggles within the context of the Cold War. And so kind of moving forward, the US and OECD countries, I think, should work with African countries to mutually establish trust. And I think that's one area that's been severely eroded, not just by history, but from an African perspective, kind of much more recently during the US Trump presidency, the response to the COVID-19 crisis, when rather than solidarity, there was a kind of, retreat and diminishing of a global response. And also, and this is important to highlight as it affects Europe and also the US, the rise of nativist politics that kind of harks back to a kind of imperial nostalgia. And Russia, as Henning rightly mentioned, is also experiencing that. And for African countries, it's important that they see that.
But speaking of South Africa, South Africa is one of the African countries that has received maybe the most critique from the international community, or should we say rather, the OECD and the West for its Russian politics. The government in Pretoria has welcomed Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, twice so far this year, and the country has also engaged in military exercises with Russia. The USA has also accused South Africa of providing Russia with military equipment. So do you think Ramaphosa will go in person to the Russia-Africa summit in July? And how is the debate in Russia on Russia in South African politics and media in general? Big question.
I wish I would know if Ramaphosa goes. And I'm tempted to assume he himself doesn't know.
Oh.
I think South African politics faces a huge dilemma. We need to understand that the South African government is not identical with the ANC as the party representing the government. There are factions in the ANC. And you have the Falcons, the hardcore Russian supporters, who are pressurizing the government. One needs to understand the complexity of the South African situation. The government is caught between a rock and a hard place. There are meaningful numbers of civil society agencies who are extremely critical of what is perceived a pro-Russia policy. But you have in the ANC a huge ideological battle where you have a very strong influence of a hardcore faction solidly in support of being on the side of Russia. And the government needs to embark on a balancing act. You mentioned that Lavrov visited twice. Well, the South Africans sent a high caliber delegation to the White House. And you could say it was a desperate effort to counteract the perception. Ramaphosa has appointed an independent commission of investigation, dispute around the Russian ship, which was in December in Simonstown. Reportedly, the commission has submitted the findings, and they will be made public within the next couple of weeks. So you can actually see there are a variety of signs trying to flag that it's not only lopsided in favor of Russia, it's more an attempt to find something in between. And the maneuvering around the BRICS summit in August, and if Putin is coming or not, was solved in a way much to the relief of the government, that Putin, not necessarily entirely voluntarily, offered that he's not interested in attending. So you could actually, if you try to look at it in a positive way, argue that was a major success of South African diplomacy without showing any form of betrayal in the abstention to condemn Russia.
How likely is it that BRICS will really alter the financial landscape as we know it? Can these group of unlikely bedfellows really undermine American hegemony? And also, what about France's sudden interest in BRICS? A lot of questions in one. Who would like to go first? Patience?
Yeah, I think the BRICS summit, I think, will be the really, really interesting meeting to watch. Effectively, you have, you know, large emerging economies, of which China and India are the largest. As it is, they cover kind of roughly 40% of the global population. And even though the kind of global trade footprint is still not high, kind of hovering between 15 to 20% in those marks, I mean, there has been significant interest from a number of African countries, including Algeria and Ethiopia, to join. And that's not to mention, you know, other countries beyond. That effectively might potentially reshape what the economic landscape looks like. And it's important to remember that BRICS was initially kind of set up as an economic kind of grouping of emerging economies wanting significant influence, with South Africa, of course, being the most important, one of the most important on the continent. So I think coming up for discussion will be about membership. There was an announcement that 40 countries or so had expressed an interest to join. France had indicated that it would like to come to the meeting. I was checking news much more recently. It doesn't look like they'll be attending, and it's not too clear who will be kind of like the kind of broad invitation list. I haven't seen that yet, but I think 69 countries or so have been invited to the meeting. Almost all of them, from what I understand, Global South countries. And the invitation list doesn't seem to include Western countries. And at the heart, I think, is the kind of what many countries see as the unfair economic financial architecture, which in Africa, having experienced radical structural economic reforms from the 80s, that's seen them implement protracted austerity policies and also kind of saddled with significant financial debt as a result of the country seen as higher risk, so effectively bearing a higher financial burden, there is a keen interest into looking towards alternatives. And the BRICS has what they have, the New Development Bank. New membership might expand the financing. There is talk of de-dollarization of the economy. Those several countries, including South Africa, saying, well, that's not what we're interested in. But there is effectively a critique of these kind of key financial institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, effectively, and in particular, the fact that African countries and significant Global South countries do not have a voice, even though they're reliant highly on these financial infrastructures. So I would see the interest, in particular from African countries, is that I think it kind of offers them an opportunity, I think, for kind of real politic leveraging around these economic concerns.
Henning?
I would like to add another aspect.
Please do.
The five BRICS countries do not think alike. Needless to point at the tensions between India and China. I think Brazil has different interests in its agenda. And even China and Russia do not really agree on everything. So while everything is absolutely correct, what Patience says, there is something else looming in the background. How does BRICS reinvent itself? And how does the individual interest of the five core members, which exists now, plays out in that new formation? I think the verdict is out. And the other interesting question for me is, if there is such a big expansion of BRICS, which would turn its back on the idea you have the powerhouses of the Global South, and you add countries like Algeria and others with annual GDP, which is minute compared with those five, how is the internal dynamics unfolding? Who is setting the tune and the agenda? And to what extent does it undermine the non-aligned movement? All of a sudden, you have a new economic alliance, which to a large extent is recruited from member states of the non-aligned movement. How does that play out? So I think it's far too early to judge, and even the BRICS summit itself will not provide the answers. It's totally in flux.
I just want to say that, yeah, I very much agree with you, Henning. I think that there's a lot of possibility for the BRICS summit to come out with new positions and better trading arrangements amongst the core members. But I would be really surprised to see any trickle-down benefit to the other attending countries. I think that it's very interesting because the non-aligned movement is going to be presided over by Uganda starting in 2024. And that is it's currently presided over by Azerbaijan. And it's quite interesting to think that the membership between the non-aligned movement and BRICS isn't exactly the same in terms of these five powers. That Russia is not a member of the non-aligned movement is important. That China is actually not a member. So I think that's quite interesting. I do think that the two configurations, the two bodies, have very similar ideological positions about the global economic order, exactly as Patience has said about, you know, the kind of unfair advantages in terms of, or disadvantages in terms of accessing capital and investment and all of that. But I'm very skeptical that BRICS will become, I think that it won't necessarily change anything. I think that the powerful founding members of BRICS will continue to run BRICS. But I also think, and this is my skepticism and my fear, that we're really entering into a very, very strange time. I do think there's a real reason and moral reason reckoning that needs to happen in international relations between the Global South and the Global North. But I also see the nativism and then the unity that the EU and the West have, as opposed to the disunity of the Global South. I think that there's a little bit of, and I also frankly am a bit skeptical, as I said, that some of these countries don't really have in the Global South. In Africa, they don't necessarily have the institutional or the institutions to kind of really organize themselves around one common ideological position. The whole experiment or strategy with regards to regional integration and the African Union is still quite, as much as there's been some progress with the African Continental Trade Agreement, there's still quite a lot of work that needs to be done. I would much rather that the show that is BRICS and that is even the non-aligned movement kind of takes a back seat to that integration process of building intra-African trade, intra-African relations and unity. I mean, it's always clear to me, if you even just look at the UN Security Council and how the Security Council works, when the African members are not always consistent in voting with each other at the council. Whereas every elected member from the Western Europe group always votes in unity with France and the UK and takes the EU position. So there is a lot of discipline and a lot of consistency. I'm just talking about sort of strategic and tactical measures here. I'm not talking about the moral aspect. I do think that Africa needs to really work on getting its own unity and organization. And I think that both of these events, the Russia-Africa Summit and the BRICS Summit and the Nonaligned Movement Summit, and there'll be a China-Africa meeting and a U.S. There's already calls for another U.S.-Africa Summit. In some ways, they're dangerous because they pull African countries continuously pursuing their own self-interest and national interest, when actually unity would make them much better, stronger bargainers for changing the global order.
Yeah, I agree, and with both you and Henning. And I think that it's also quite interesting to note that I suspect that for a number of the countries that will be attending, the main draw card is China, rather than so much the other countries. Mm. Given in particular the interest in kind of infrastructure projects and economic investments in the various countries. And it's also interesting to note about the kind of proliferation of these summits and their distraction of African countries from the kind of broader African continental agenda. Also kind of raised, there was a meeting I attended earlier in the year in South Africa where they were like, well, you know, why are African leaders spending all their time attending all these summits, you know, whittling from east to west, to, you know, to Europe, if they should be bringing all the actors to the continent. Yes. And laying out, you know, well, this, and saying, this is our agenda, what is it that you can offer? And the absence of that, I totally agree, speaks towards a kind of fragmented and unified position. But it also kind of highlights, I think, the kind of absence effectively of that knowledge base or paucity of that knowledge base on the continent to be able to kind of assess the shifting global situation and make decisions on the basis of Africa's strategic interests.
I see Angela is excited about something. Please.
I'm so sorry. Good patience, because it's a question I've had as well. And now we come to the root of it, which is when you say that there's this paucity, I think that we all three here will know that there's tons of expertise and knowledge on the continent in African universities, and our colleagues, our friends, a whole network that works with the Nordic Africa Institute of African Researchers that are very wise and savvy and knowledgeable empirically, theoretically about these things. However, are African governments listening to them?
No.
Exactly. I think that they are not listening to them or taking their knowledge and expertise seriously and letting that knowledge and expertise guide their policy and their positions and their approach.
The bottom line means good governance matters.
Exactly.
Yes.
That is the guiding principle. And as long as the African elites betray good governance, it doesn't help that they chat through the world and meet with other elites over champagne and fancy dinners.
Well, thank you so much, Patience, Henning, Angela, and thank you for our listeners. We would like to say that on our website, you can find a reading list to go with this episode. Very interesting episode, I must say myself. And you can also find our previous podcast episodes. And thank you for listening. Thank you so much.
Thank you.